And at the same time, I met my current business partner, Trina, in that experience. We met at that company. And, you know, you learn a lot about people in those really challenging moments. And she was just complete grace, and she was courageous and showed positivity under the worst of circumstances. And we started thinking, what if we did this together, this kind of thing? And what if we did it a little bit differently? And so we did.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to the Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Jesse Finkelstein. Jesse is a book publishing insider and co-founder of Page Two Books, where she works with authors to bring their big ideas to the page. Have you ever said to yourself, I think I might write a book? I have, dozens of times. And if you're wondering, no, I still haven't written one. So I really love Jesse demystifying the process for me and sharing her advice for first-time authors. Jesse takes us through her wild entrepreneurial journey from working at the publishing house for Harry Potter, getting let go with two young kids at home, and eventually starting her own company. We talk about all the decisions that go into creating an immersive, frictionless experience for the reader. And it turns out, it's a lot like designing any customer experience. We also talk about the power of regret, harnessing creativity, and how smaller publishers are giving marginalized groups a voice for the first time. Please enjoy Jesse Finkelstein. All right. Welcome, Jesse, to the show. It feels like it's been a long time since we had this scheduled, and I've been looking forward to it. So thanks for being here.
It's really my pleasure. I've been very excited to have this chat with you, Bob.
So it's early morning there in Vancouver, and I was thinking about, I haven't been to Vancouver in a couple of years, but I'll tell you what comes to mind when I think of Vancouver. I think of, it's incredibly beautiful. I think of some of the highest housing prices in North America. I think of really bad traffic. So I'm just curious, I'm always interested in sort of the baggage and the biases that I bring to conversations. So if people are thinking about Vancouver in those terms, or maybe something else, what do you think people would be surprised to hear about Vancouver? What's it like living there?
Well, I agree with everything you just said, though you live in the Toronto area, so I don't know what you're saying about traffic necessarily. Yeah. It is pretty right. Bad here. I agree. I think for those of us who live here, and I don't know if this would be totally surprising, but I think of the word quiet. And that has both some positive and maybe some negative connotations. I'm originally from Montreal, and I really love the hum of the, you know, a big city. I love the spirit of a big city. And Vancouver doesn't really have that kind of spirit. I think it has a spirit of quiet and calm. And, you know, not always, not every day, but to me, that's sort of the dominant feeling that, and I think it's a reason a lot of people come here. I ended up here for work specifically, but I do think that that people sort of are always seeking that kind of grounded calm and quiet here.
Interesting. I've never heard it articulate like that, the spirit of it. I like that. So you mentioned that you were born in Montreal. I've got so many questions. I'd love to hear more about what took you to Vancouver.
Well, I came to Vancouver because at the time it was the only place you could do a master's degree in publishing. And at that point, I really knew that book publishing was it for me. That's what I wanted to do. So I had studied English literature in Montreal at McGill. And I could have stayed in that city forever, to be honest. That's really where I belong. But I knew that I had to go elsewhere to study. And initially, I thought it was going to be New York or Toronto. But there is a university here in Vancouver, Simon Fraser. They offer a stellar master's program, and you really get exposure into every aspect of the publishing industry, and you actually have to engage with every aspect. And then you do an internship as part of it. So I was really attracted to that level of immersion and exposure and to the internship. And as it turns out, I ended up doing my internship here at a company called Raincoast that had the Canadian rights to the Harry Potter series. And I'm going to track you back to the year 2000. Book four was launching that summer. And that series had just exploded. So I had the opportunity to work as assistant to the president. And I had the most amazing exposure to one of the biggest book phenomena of all time through that internship role. I eventually was hired there, and that's why I ended up staying here and really building a career on the West Coast. That's what took me here, work.
Okay, so you just mentioned a couple of really interesting things. I just want to go back to, I think, something you said at the outset. You said you knew early on that you wanted to work in publishing or something to that effect. I'm always so interested in the very few people that I find that seem to have known from an early age, or at least early in their careers, exactly what they wanted to do. They found that purpose or connection to something that, frankly, most people seem to search for their whole careers. So can you tell me a little bit more about how you knew that's what you wanted to do and where that came from?
I was a bit worried coming onto your podcast, having listened to the extraordinary journeys of so many of the people you've interviewed. I thought this is going to be the most straight line conversation of any, I predict, of any of your podcast interviews. I was a book nerd. I loved books. I loved reading. I grew up reading and speaking in English and French, both. So I was so fascinated by the fact that, you know, just the way that we express ourselves in our own, in different languages, we can render parts of our personality so differently. I feel I'm a little bit different in when I'm speaking in French and immersed in, you know, the French language than when I'm speaking or reading in English. So I was so fascinated by that. I always loved reading, and it felt like the only thing I was really good at. The thing that I loved the most and the thing that I was good at was reading and being able to write in association with what I was reading. It wasn't just sort of creative writing. I was never that interested in my own writing, but I really loved writing about other people's work, studying literature, like really peering into the text. And so I knew that I wanted to work with books in some capacity. When I started learning about book publishing, I realized, wow, in this capacity, I could be serving and supporting authors to make great books. It just felt like a really natural fit. The problem was I didn't know how to do it. And so it wasn't until my last year of university, after kind of just, you know, reading a lot, writing a lot, and thinking, how am I going to parlay this into a career? I learned about this program. And it was really, that program was just a linchpin for everything else that followed.
I mean, I know nothing about the book publishing business. So I'd love to understand a little bit, like, what do you think people don't understand about it? Or maybe you could give just a brief overview of working in for a big publishing house. How do books get made? Is that a ridiculous question?
No, actually, I have two answers to your sort of multi-pronged question. So how do books get made? One of the things that I love about book publishing is that there are some aspects of the craft, you know, the art of it, that have been quite beautifully honored and preserved by practitioners. And, you know, here I immediately think of the team we've built at my company, Page Two. When we set out to launch a company, we thought, who are the people who just are the absolute artists in each area of editorial, design, sales and marketing, production? And in some ways, a lot of what we do in publishing has looked the same for some time, with a lot of, you know, innovation, technological innovation thrown in as well. But you know, for example, our creative director, Peter, is a professor of typography in addition to doing design work and running a design team. And he he would tell you fascinating things about the way in which the way we use typography now, people think, oh, well, you could just kind of stick your book, you know, run it through some kind of an online mill, basically, and have it output on the other side, and it's a book. And that's, of course, that's absolutely true if you're just thinking about the text itself. But if you're thinking about the reading experience, Peter would say there are elements of typography, even as we have, you know, learned, gone from the early stages of the printing press to now knowing how to do everything on a computer. There are elements of that that have been preserved for generations and built on and enhanced. So in order to create the optimal reading experience. So next time you pick up a book, take a look and see what you can notice about that. What's the intention that's gone into the way a book has been edited, for example? How many times have you read a book and thought, oh, that could have been half the length? Guess what? It probably should have been half the length. Maybe the editing wasn't strong enough. Maybe the author and editor hadn't partnered in quite the right way to create the right result. Or if you think that the text is really small, I don't know, some of us think that's just our age and eyesight. But actually, if it's been thoughtfully done, they're thoughtfully designed, you should have a really beautiful reading experience. And you know, when you have a really good experience as a reader, you know the difference. So for book publishing, there are these phases of work and expertise we apply all the way through in the entire process, from, you know, concept development through editorial guidance on your manuscript to design and production, and then printing, all the different, you can imagine, there are so many different outputs for a book now. So you could have print, you know, the actual printed edition. And then, of course, we have ebooks, audiobooks. So many different ways of getting books out into the produced and out into the landscape, and then great sales and marketing and distribution, both digitally and in brick and mortar stores. I've just kind of outlined the process in the broadest terms. What people don't know about publishing, to answer your original question, and what they might be surprised to know, is that I think we're really seeing a sea change right now in the accessibility of really great publishing options. I think for many decades, through, you know, this century and the last one, we had a scenario where there were a relatively small number of publishers that were the gatekeepers for what got published. And now it's not just that there are more publishers, there have always been, you know, a good sort of ecosystem, at least in my experience, but there are different kinds of publishers that can help you do different things. So there's not any one way to go about this. Despite the best practices that I did mention, there are some best practices, but in terms of the overall model, there are many different ways of getting this done. And I think that what's emerged are is a great diversity of options in terms of how to get your book into the landscape.
God, that's amazing. I must admit, I've never given any thought when I crack a book to the thought that's gone into the reading experience, especially as, you know, maybe attention spans, maybe I should just speak to my own attention spans. Like, I'll give a book 20 or 30 pages, or I'll listen to an audiobook and give it, you know, 20 minutes. And I don't really have much invested in it. I'm going to pay much more attention to that. And in particular, you were kind enough to share with me a couple of books from page two. So I'm really curious to go back and see, now can I see the care that Jesse and the company put into this book compared to other ones that I might have sitting on my bookshelf?
That's great. Let me know what you find out.
Yes.
You know, what my team would say is that it's a positive and negative space thing. Often, if you're not an expert in publishing, and so you're not already looking for those things, you would notice when there's a point of friction, or when something was uncomfortable or didn't go right. That's what you would notice. If it's done really well, you don't necessarily notice. Like, great design is sometimes invisible, right? And it's not to say it's not beautiful. You can recognize that it's beautiful, but a design that really enhances the reading experience is meant to not get in the way. It's not intrusive. And same with great editorial. You should just be reading and immersed in the work and feeling that it's coherent and the flow really works and it just works. So I'd say if you're reading anything and you're not noticing those points of friction, it's probably a lot of thought has gone into the entire thing, as well as, of course, it being a really well-written book in the first place. That's totally necessary.
I love that. I work with a lot of tech founders, and of course, we spend a lot of time thinking about the experience that they're delivering through whatever, whether it's technology or services that they're providing to their customers. And we agonize over every little thing and removing friction from the process and improving that experience. It's never once occurred to me that that kind of thought has gone into reading. That's really amazing. I love that. So a couple of other things that you, I just wanted to circle back on. You mentioned being at that publishing house when Harry Potter was blowing up. So what was that experience like for you, and how did it inform what you wanted to do with the next season of your career?
I think that experience actually taught me a lot about just really good management and good partnership. The person who was running the company at the time was someone I still think of with such admiration. He is such a wonderful person and really thoughtful about the company, the people in the company, how we worked together. I mean, my first day on the job as his assistant, he pulled me into his office, seemed very serious. He was actually a total jokester. He said, "I have some important things to share." And I thought he was going to tell me how I needed to do my job. He pointed to a whole bunch of photos on his desk and said, "This is my family. These are my kids. These are my dogs." And he said, "If any one of them calls me at any time and needs me, please come find me. Nothing else is more important." And he lent that ethos as well, that the humanity of the experience, to everything that he did. So I learned a lot about book publishing from him, but I really learned a lot about how you treat each other, I mean, in an office environment and also in the world. And I watched him and the people, you know, the rest of that management team. And again, that was the opportunity I had as an assistant. I might have been pouring coffee for people, but I was also really listening in, and I had access to what was some really sort of high level stuff that was happening. And I watched how deftly they negotiated certain things within a global phenomenon. Everybody wanted those rights. They couldn't take anything for granted. I watched how they managed the incredible opportunity that they had with that series. Some other, I think, people who were not as experienced or not as wise as managers probably would have grown in a way that was unsustainable. And they probably would have really just jumped the shark at that point. Grown too fast, done too much, really tried to expand beyond their reach. And I feel that they took the opposite approach. They were really quite conservative in how they managed everything. And it was strategic. And as a result, they're still thriving today. They're in business, they're thriving, even though, of course, that series was a one-time phenomenon, really. They've had many other wins since then. And I still know them, speaking of partnership, because when Page Two, when we were ready to go and reach out for distribution partners, guess who we reached out to? So that same company is now handling our distribution within Canada. So I just learned a lot about business, I would say. Now, we also fully recognize the fact that this was a complete outlier experience. I mean, I had my boss calling me from the Sky Dome when J.K. Rowling was on a book talk series, which normally you're lucky if you can get 30 people in seats in your local bookstore, right? That's like a great turnout. J.K. Rowling was doing a reading at the Sky Dome. We've never seen anything like it before or since. I had him calling me saying, "I'm at a reading at the Sky Dome. These things do not line up. You know, this is unprecedented." And so I got to have that sort of wild ride and just embrace the opportunity that it afforded to learn a lot about what can happen kind of at the fringes, at the outer extremes. of book publishing. So I, you know, we all had to take that with a grain of salt and know this isn't necessarily something you can build on. It's not, that's like winning the lottery. It's not how I've built my business, though I don't shy away from being visionary about opportunities at the same time.
Yeah, that's amazing. So did you start Page Two directly from there?
No. So speaking of learnings, that company, once the Harry Potter series was finished, you know, we knew the whole time that it was planned as a limited series. The company decided to restructure, and they had been originally a distribution company. And just to be specific, the difference between publishing and distribution is effectively book publishing. You are making the books from the ground up. You're working with the authors to kind of build out the content and all the other pieces that I described earlier. Distribution, you are effectively moving inventory around. You are handling sales representation, warehousing, fulfillment, exactly what it is in other industries too. So two different related businesses. And that company had originally been a distribution company. They did some publishing and they were very opportunistic, good for them, in taking advantage of having a publishing department that could handle a series like Harry Potter when they bought the rights and decided to publish it, you know, within the territory themselves. But they closed that department and I was laid off along with everyone else in the publishing department at the time. I was pregnant with my second child. So it was a tough moment, tender days. And I had to figure out what was next. I completely understood their decision. I'm not just saying that in retrospect, but really even at the time, I got it from a business standpoint. It made sense, but it was hard on me. So I had to then figure out what was I going to do. I found another job at another publisher. They were smaller, but they were still Canada's largest independent at the time. Initially, I was hired to be the digital assets director at the time when ebooks were first becoming a thing, right? And the whole industry was in a blind panic, thinking this is going to be our Napster moment. No one's going to read print anymore. We're all going down. And the way I saw it was, I don't know. I think this might just be an opportunity for publishing to just get books into more hands. And I think as it turns out, that is what's in fact happened. And I'm sure you've had this experience, Bob. Some people they want to listen to the audiobook when they're in their car and then they buy the book, the ebook or the print book so that they can read it at home. I don't want to suggest it's all been, you know, wine and roses. There have been a lot of challenges along the way. But I think that we have seen an expansion of opportunities within the industry. And it was a very cool opportunity for me to be the, you know, one of the first people at the company doing this kind of work. So all that to say, I got that job. I was promoted ultimately to chief operating officer. And that was at a time when the company was in financial distress. To its credit, they had done an amazing job of competing with some of the really big publishers. And yet as a medium-sized independent, that's a really, really tough place to be. You don't have the deep pockets that a multinational publisher like Penguin Random House would have if you want to kind of throw money at someone in order to be able to attract them to your house, even if you know that it's not necessarily going to earn out on book one. Maybe book two will be the big one, you know, et cetera. Any independent sized company can't really compete at that level. And unfortunately, it went through a bankruptcy process. And that was one of the most devastating moments of my career. I spent many months trying to support, sell the assets of the company, ensure a safe transition to other companies, ensure a safe transition for the staff. It was just heartbreaking. And at the same time, I met my current business partner, Trina, in that experience. We met at that company. And, you know, you learn a lot about people in those really challenging moments. And she was just complete grace and she was courageous and showed positivity under the worst of circumstances. And we started thinking, what if we did this together, this kind of thing? And what if we did it a little bit differently? So I would say if we hadn't gone through that really challenging experience together, we might not have thought about starting our own firm. And so we did.
So yeah, you started saying that this would be, you know, an uninteresting journey because it's a straight line. It's never a straight line. There's all, you know, you've already talked about some things that are much, you know, you don't have to scratch very long before we realize under the surface that, yeah, every one of these stories that on the surface seems like a bit of a fairy tale about a young woman that finds her purpose and is able to make a living following her calling in the only industry or the only job that she's ever wanted. So it's inspiring, but that's amazing. So tell me about a little bit about Page Two and why it's different from other options that authors have.
So I'll say, first of all, we work on nonfiction projects. And I say that first because different categories of publishing, I think, deserve to be handled in very different ways from a strategic point of view, from a creative point of view. In this part of the conversation, I'll sort of set aside fiction, poetry, other categories, and focus exclusively on nonfiction. So Trina and I wanted to set up a publishing house that would serve and support people who want to change the conversation, not just through books, but in every other part of their world. So we had in mind not necessarily a subject area. So we didn't set out to say, well, we want to publish business books, personal growth, but we had an author mindset in mind. And we wanted to work with people who are very entrepreneurial, for whom it's really important to have a high degree of agency and creative control in the process and strategic control. We just liked that idea of a real meeting of minds that can happen and a real sense of partnership. That's the thing about Page Two. The reason it's called Page Two, there were two of us at the, you know, as founders, co-founders. And we think about the author and publisher partnership as one that should be a real meeting of minds. And what I found in traditional publishing is that as much as it can work beautifully if that alignment exists between the author and the publisher, it operates in a licensing model. So the author is granting their publishing rights to the publisher, and the publisher also assumes the right, therefore, to make all of the decisions. How does the book look? How does it feel? When is it published? How is it priced? And naturally, the publisher is the expert on that stuff. But the kind of author we wanted to work with also has a high degree of market intelligence. They know their readers. They know their audience, I should say, even if they haven't published a book before. They know what they like, what they need, what they want. And so we thought, well, what if we set up a service model instead of a licensing model? So it's one in which the author pays us to do the work and the author earns the revenue on the book. So it's really sort of flipping the traditional model on its head. The author therefore doesn't license rights to us. We're in service to them. And so the author has a high degree of freedom, has actual complete freedom in the ultimate result. So and I'll just ground this in an example. Let's say we have an expert who has been building out their business landscape using a certain colors for their brand identity, using certain form of messaging, the work that they do in the world and the way they present themselves to their communities. So the book should align with that in a meaningful way. And so we get to start the conversation there with our authors. It's not just, let's make a great book that's going to work well out in the book retail landscape. That's important. But we also say, well, what's important to you? Are you doing keynotes? Are you doing conferences? What is your business cycle? And we build the whole strategy around that. So that's the difference with Page Two. We also are a boutique publisher, so we limit the number of books we publish every year, despite what I'm proud to say is there's considerable interest in our company. We really want to maintain that boutique level experience so we can meaningfully partner with our authors. And then we get to watch these moments of trans- transformation for them in their careers. It's not just becoming an author for the sake of it, but it's actually, what is that book? What kinds of doors is that book opening for you in the rest of your world? It's amazing to bear witness to that experience and actually to help be a part of it.
Yeah, that's so good. I was reflecting before this conversation, Jesse, and I talked to a lot of people who think about writing a book. This resonates with me as well. It's kind of like public speaking. I used to do some public speaking. Now I think, should I get back into it? And then I'm like, well, maybe I need a book to do that. And I always come back to the why. Do I want to just feel good about myself and say that I've always wanted to write a book and I did it, so I can check that box? Is it because I want to have a broader impact? Is it because I want to fill out part of my business by generating more leads or providing more value? I don't know. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, does it matter why an author wants to write a book?
Oh, it absolutely does. If we feel that the author's why, it's not that we have anything to say about their why belongs to them. But if we feel that their why doesn't necessarily connect with what we feel they can achieve, even with our help, then the alignment doesn't exist, for instance. So let's say an author feels that they really want to publish a book because they think it's going to get them on bigger stages for public speaking. If that author's already on small stages and there's something working really well and we can work with them on a book that aligns with a keynote that then they're going to leverage to be able to get those bigger opportunities, oh, 100% we can work with that. But if an author is doing almost no speaking and has a vision, their why is for, you know, I want to be the next Brené Brown, or I want to become a guru of some sort by virtue of publishing this book, and we can't see the arc readily of how one gets from here to there. We know that a book doesn't create that change. It has to be part of a more grounded strategy. And we're all about being both visionary and grounded. Back to Harry Potter, right? Sometimes miracles do happen, but we don't build and plan for that. We build and plan for the real transformation we know we can help support. And then if something miraculous happens beyond that, we're all really thrilled about it. So that's where the why really matters to us. But we honor the why that any author has. I think it's a really good question to ask. One of our authors, her name is AJ Harper. She's one of the most intelligent and insightful book consultants, coaches, and writers out there. And we published her book, Write a Must Read. And AJ is really fierce about that why, saying, does this need to be a book? Should it be a podcast? Should it be something else? And it's not to say you shouldn't write a book, but it's about what book should you write and when and why. And she actually talks on a recent episode of her own podcast. And this is a woman who's written many, many books. She's a deep expert. And she spent an entire podcast just sharing with vulnerability the fact that she has three different book ideas. She wants to do all of them for different reasons. So she is now going back, right, like back to basics and running her own process on herself to determine that. So know that, Bob, the kind of question you're asking yourself, that's the right question. And every author, no matter how much of an expert you are or not, should be thinking about that strategically.
Yeah. And I guess as I think about it, when they ask people near the end of their lives or in the last season of their lives what they regret most, it's very rarely things they did. It's usually things they didn't do. And so here I am, and I'm like, I've often kind of toyed with the idea of writing a book. And I totally agree with what you're saying. I've reflected on, I ask myself the same questions that most people ask. What the hell would I write about? Why would I write it? There's probably a dozen reasons that would make it harder. But lately I've been thinking, yeah, but I don't want to get to be at the end of my life and for one of those things to be, yeah, I always wanted to write a book, but I didn't. And I also don't want to write one when I'm 70 and look back and say, shit, why didn't I do this when I was 50? So I understand what you're saying. I guess what I'm struggling with, and I think what a lot of people struggle with, is how do I accelerate that?
Well, I have two suggestions as you think about that, and for anyone thinking about that. One would be to think about different books for different purposes. So someone might have the drive to write for the sake of it, right? I just want to express myself. That's one thing. That may or may not be you, Bob. For me, for instance, I don't have that interest or ability. If I ever do write a book, and Trina and I have often thought about writing a book about publishing, it would likely be, the strategy there would be not writing for writing's sake. It would be about conveying an idea that should be conveyed in book form. And again, that's a big question. Is it a podcast? Is it an article, right? Could we do the same thing in a smaller format? Or does that long form really work for what we want to achieve? And then you could think about legacy. Is there a work that's really important for you to have in the world for the sake of your family, and you want to share a story about your family and have that preserved? I think if we can get away from the idea of the book in the abstract, and the book is something like it's only quote unquote successful if it's really out everywhere, whatever that means anymore. Like, you know, this outdated idea of a book that becomes supposedly successful in its field and is just out in the zeitgeist and the landscape. And it's like, well, if you can't do that, you can't be the Brené Brown, then why would you even try? But I think really everyone should think about purpose. And I don't know, I have an expert whose work we published last year, it's a very niche topic. And he said to me, Jesse, only 1,000 people need this book, but I need all 1,000 of those people to read it. And that was the game changer for him in his career and in his world. To me, I loved that project as much as I loved working on an outlier like Harry Potter. No joke. It was just as satisfying for me to know that I was helping to create that kind of movement and transformation in his field. And when you think about creativity, really unpack that. I know you've talked about that a lot on the podcast, Bob, and I'd love to hear how some of your guests have explored that. To me, thinking about how a leader within a company would manage a bankruptcy process, how you would manage an influx of a Harry Potter, how you would manage, you know, needing to build something from scratch the way that Trina and I have, and kind of reinvent certain parts of your model that you've worked in for years. I think those are relentlessly creative endeavors. I feel I do cartwheels every day, and my team does. And that it's easy to see in our design team how creativity plays out in a more classic sense. But I think everyone on my team is engaging creativity. It's amazing. When we launched Page Two, we used to work in other categories of publishing as well as nonfiction. And some of our close publishing friends said, oh, aren't you going to miss working on the really creative stuff, the fiction and poetry and things like that? And we were like, are you kidding? Have you met an entrepreneur? Have you met a leader in their space? Working with people of that caliber and nature and mindset is incredibly inspiring, and it demands creativity, and they are creative in the most profound ways I've ever seen.
Yeah, you're right. We have talked a bit about that on the podcast. I love the way you frame that. And it really is about reframing creativity, right? Because working with lots of founders and entrepreneurs, you could certainly frame creativity as that is all they do, trying to figure out, in perpetual kind of problem solving and coming up with new ways of dealing with things. I love that. My experience, even with this podcast, has been, and some of the best advice I ever got was, don't worry about what it's about. Just start it. Find some interesting people, have conversations, follow your curiosity, record them and put it out there. And what the podcast is about and what really resonates with you and your audience will emerge. And I think about whether that would apply to writing, because I think the thing that holds me back is that fear of judgment. You know, I sit down and write for half a page, like, oh, that is garbage. And we recently had a guest on who was mentored by Maya Angelou for a number of years. And Maya would say, yeah, she would write for 8 hours and come out with one sentence. I mean, that terrifies me. That's probably supposed to bring me some comfort. But I guess the point is, I'm wondering whether I should just start writing and see what happens?
If someone has the impulse to do that, I would never hold you back. I would say, just go, follow your impulse. But you've actually brought me back, Bob, to a second piece of advice that I wanted to share and forgot. Hire the best possible support that you can afford. I feel very passionate about this. If someone is really interested in writing a book, there is nothing better than finding an editor or a book coach or someone deeply experienced in books, in your subject area, someone who really knows not only how to coach you through developing an outline and writing, but also who understands the business and who can help you position your book in the market. So you're taking a very professional look at what you're doing in addition to helping give you the framework you need to write. That can be really transformational. And I talk about affordability. Not everyone can afford to hire a personal book coach. It can be very expensive because it's very high touch work. But there are great books. I mentioned AJ's book, Write a Must Read.
Right.
Following that, reading a book like that and following the suggestions and recommendations can be hugely helpful as well. So going to seek really deep experts and following their guidance, I think, cannot be underestimated.
I love this conversation, Jesse. There's so many different threads I've shared with Amy before. You know, the hardest part of having amazing conversations like this is the next 48 hours from starting right now, because I'll just be like, oh my God, how did I not ask her about this? Oh, she left that thread just dangling for me and I didn't follow up on it. Or God, I need to have another conversation with her about this. And this has definitely been one of those conversations. I mean, we've talked about creativity and your entrepreneurial journey and page two and, you know, advice to authors. I can't thank you enough. It's been so amazing. Just the last thing that I wanted to ask about is, what are you most excited about now?
I think I'm most excited about the fact that new publishing models are giving rise to new opportunities for authors of all different stripes. For instance, we have the amazing privilege of working with a number of Indigenous leaders for whom it's really important to publish in a way that gives them complete ownership of their work, telling their own story in exactly the way that they want to. And it's not to say that they wouldn't have published before, but I think that they are publishing in a new way. And it's an honor to be a part of that journey where we can support those kinds of initiatives. So I feel very optimistic, despite the considerable challenges we see and have seen for, you know, forever in the publishing industry with respect to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and being able to ensure that marginalized voices are represented and people who otherwise wouldn't have had the opportunity to express themselves for all different kinds of reasons in the way that they want to. I feel more positive than ever about those opportunities.
That is such a positive and inspiring kind of thought to end on, Jesse. So I want to be mindful of your time. You've been so generous with it in all of the conversations we've had leading up to this. I just want to acknowledge all the support and guidance you've provided me, and it's really meant a lot to me. So thank you, and thank you for doing this.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I'm a behind the scenes person. It's really fun to be on this side of the mic. And I really appreciate it, Bob. Thank you for including me among your amazing roster of guests. And it's a great pleasure.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.